Guerrilla warfare, an invention of the Vietnamese. Think again. Think back 4,000 years again. With us today, Max Boot, author of Invisible Armies. Uncommon Knowledge Now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. The Jean J. Kirkpatrick Senior Fellow in National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, Max Boot, is a journalist and military historian whose books include The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars and the Rise of American Power, and War Made New, Technology, Warfare, and the Course of History, 1500 to Today. Max Boot's newest book, Invisible Armies, an epic history of guerrilla warfare from ancient times to the present. Max Boot, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Peter.
My pleasure. Define guerrilla warfare.
Well, it's a little bit like pornography. You know it when you see it, but it's a little hard to nail it down in print. Essentially, it's using hit-and-run tactics by forces that typically don't wear uniforms and don't have all of the paraphernalia of conventional military forces. In essence, it's everything except conventional wars pitting one regular uniformed army against another, which in fact, everything else is the vast majority of human conflict.
Well, you're anticipating, but guerrilla in Spanish means little war, I think.
It does.
It?
I mean, the term was actually coined during the Peninsula War when the Spanish resisted the French legions of Napoleon from 1808 to 1814. But the practice it describes is as ancient as mankind, and it's gone by many different names, both in the old days and today.
Next question then. Guerrilla, little war.
Yes.
With the notes and bibliography, Invisible Armies comes to over 700 pages. Why is guerrilla warfare so important that you devoted several years of your life to it?
Well, 6 years and over 700 pages, and I had to leave a lot out because the more you look, the more guerrilla warfare you find. This is the dominant form of warfare throughout history, Peter. I mean, it's amazing how important and how pervasive it is. We have a tendency to say, oh, well, there really haven't been any big wars since World War II or the Korean War, maybe the Gulf War. And we forget that all the wars that are going on in the world right now are unconventional wars, irregular wars, guerrilla wars in places like Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere. And that's not uncommon. You talk about uncommon knowledge. Well, this is a common form of warfare. This is the way it's always been. This is not an anomaly. It's always been this way. So what I'm really describing is the dominant form of warfare throughout history. And so naturally, to sum that up, it takes a few pages.
All right. Beautifully written pages. Invisible Armies begins in Mesopotamia. That's more than 2,000 years BC, runs to the present. So we go across some more than 4,000 years of history, Mesopotamia, Rome, the British Empire, French Indochina, contemporary Afghanistan and Iraq. And I'm struck by two characteristics of the book. One is the vividness and particularity with which you write about these widely differing times and places. You give there's relatively little abstraction. Each moment or conflict that you're writing about, you give its due as its own entity. And yet, you close the book with 12 lessons, highly analytical. So how can it be that such disparate events across more than four millennia can have enough in common to represent, in effect, I think the implicit argument of the book is that studying guerrilla warfare represents a branch of military history unto it, represents a discipline. How can that be?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of differences between guerrilla wars, and guerrilla warfare is really the most distinctive and particular form of warfare in some ways because it's rooted in very individual conditions. And to really understand why guerrillas fight and how to defeat them, you really have to understand a society and its grievances and its outlook. But at the same time, there are also commonalities, and guerrillas are just like conventional military forces. They study the exploits of other guerrillas. In fact, this has been one of the big changes in warfare in the last 100 years is that prior to, let's say, the 19th century, guerrillas were isolated from one another. The Sioux who were fighting on North Americans' plains against American settlers didn't know what the Zulus were doing in southern Africa, even though they were facing very similar adversaries. But in the last 100 years, there's been a commonality of knowledge which has spread among not only counterinsurgent forces, but also among insurgent forces. And they've really, both sides have really made an attempt to learn lessons from history. How do you fight as an insurgent, or how do you counter an insurgency? And there are some general commonalities that have emerged, which I think are very relevant for when you think about the course of conflicts today. And so that's what I try to bring out at the end of the book, after trying to give each particular story its due as an epic and as a saga that deserves its own telling and its own place in the historical annals.
Let's take a few of your lessons as a way of getting into the book. Quote, in every case here, I'm just simply quoting the lesson you present in Invisible Armies. Quote, guerrilla warfare has been ubiquitous, you've already mentioned that, and important throughout history. You go on to say, for example, that the United States, again, I'm quoting you, the United States reached its present borders only by waging 3 centuries of unremitting warfare against Indian irregulars. The United States is warlike from its very inception. We tend to think of a peaceful colonists, right. Few troubles with the Indians here and there on skirmishes, and then comes the American Revolution,
right.
And then the War of 1812, and then fundamentally calm until the Civil War. But the background here is 3 centuries of colonial fighting against guerrillas.
Absolutely. We don't like to think of ourselves as being martial, but of course that's what we've been from day one, because as soon as the first settlers were landing on the eastern shore of North America, they were fighting the people who were already here, the American Indian tribes, and that warfare didn't end until 1890. And those Indians were superb fighters, superb warriors, but they did not march out en masse in formations. They did not stand in a regular battle line like the infantry of the day did in the Western world. They fought using skirmishes, ambushes, raids, using the elements of stealth and surprise. They were basically guerrilla fighters, and that was fighting them was the dominant mission of the U.S. Army when it wasn't engaged in other conflicts. But every other conflict also had a major irregular warfare phase, whether it was the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, even World War II had a lot of irregular operations. So this kind of warfare, all you have to do is look and you find it.
Max, so the cavalry raids in the Civil War, I tend to think of them as a kind of exception to the rule of Lee's in control, he's a strategist, he's got his force of maneuver and force of reserve, and Grant is doing the same thing. And then you've got these fellows doing odd, leading essentially irritation raids. But that's not quite right then, that those cavalry raids were operating within a tradition that was already pretty deeply rooted in American military history.
Absolutely. The bushwhackers, for example, the southern guerrillas who operated in Missouri were that was the major part of the war in a lot of the western states. It certainly did not decide the outcome of the Civil War, which was primarily conventional. But one of the interesting points about how the Civil War ended was the fact that the Confederate Army chose to accept surrender at Appomattox, whereas they in fact could have continued fighting a guerrilla warfare for years. And Robert E. Lee decided not to do that because he understood how fighting guerrilla war destroys the very fabric of society and destroys the ability of men of wealth and land like him to control society in the way they wanted to. And we're seeing that today, for example, in Syria, where guerrilla warfare is destroying the fabric of Syrian society. That's what Robert E. Lee wanted to avoid. He wanted to fight in a primarily conventional mode, as, by the way, did George Washington in the Revolutionary War for very similar reasons, because they understood that while guerrilla warfare can be an effective tactic, it also carries a heavy cost.
Guerrilla warfare has been both underestimated and overestimated. Explain.
Well, I think I would say, you know, prior to, let's say, 1945 or so, there was a tendency for military men in the Western world to kind of look down their noses at guerrillas, to say they're savages, they don't fight the way that gentlemen are supposed to fight, they're, you know, beneath contempt. And yet even in the pre-20th century period, there have been instances of guerrillas defeating conventional armies. For example, look at the way that Haiti won its very savage and bloody War of Independence in the 1790s, where they defeated tens of thousands of Napoleon's troops using hit-and-run tactics. But now, since 1945, there's been a tendency to go in the opposite direction and to hold up guerrillas as these 10-foot-tall superhumans who could not possibly be defeated by military force, largely because of the success of a handful of high-profile insurgents like Mao Zedong, Ho Chi Minh, Fidel Castro. A guerrilla mystique developed in the 1960s, which is exaggerated because if you look at the fate of most insurgencies, even in the post-1945 period, most of them still lose.
Invisible armies. Although often able to fight for years and inflict great losses on their enemies, guerrillas have seldom achieved their objectives. Terrorists have been even less successful. Close quote. I want to come in a moment more fully to consider the implications of your findings for America at the present moment. But this question of overestimating guerrillas and terrorists since the Second World War, a kind of preliminary finding is that we shouldn't in some way be unduly unnerved by 9/11. Even 9/11, there's still terrorists or guerrillas, unconventional forces fighting within a pattern, right?
Well, 9/11 certainly takes terrorism to a new level we haven't seen before, but and there are certainly differences between al-Qaeda and previous terrorist or guerrilla groups, but there's also a lot of commonalities. And one of those commonalities is that even in the years since 9/11, this horrific, terrible attack, al-Qaeda has not really been able to achieve its objectives. I mean, that kind of makes my point. They were seeking to drive America out of the Middle East, and in many ways, they actually made us become more involved in the Middle East. And they certainly have not succeeded in taking over a lot of countries as they had hoped to do. So even this horrific act of violence so far has been in vain from the perspective of al-Qaeda.
Invisible armies, once again. The most important development in guerrilla warfare in the last 200 years has been the rise of public opinion.
That's really been a game changer. And you know where you really saw that the game first begin to change? It was in our very own War of Independence. Because, you know, we tend to think that the battle ended at Yorktown in 1781. That was the last major battle of the American Revolution. But it didn't have to be the last major battle, because even after Yorktown, the British Empire still had tens of thousands of troops it could have thrown into the fray. And I can guarantee you that if our founding fathers had been fighting not the British Empire, but the Roman Empire, the result would not have been pretty. Washington, Adams, Jefferson, and the rest would have wound up being crucified, quite literally.
Literally.
The reason why it didn't happen in the present instance was not because the British Empire was truly defeated on the battlefield. They still had ample resources to fight. But the reason they chose not to do so was because Parliament turned against the war. And in 1782, there was a pivotal vote in the House of Commons to discontinue offensive operations. It was a very close vote, but it was a thunderous repudiation of Lord North and the Tories who wanted to fight, and it led to the rise of Lord Rockingham and his Whigs, who were committed to a policy of conciliation with their American brethren. Now, that's revolutionary, truly revolutionary, the fact that this great power has the capacity to keep fighting but chooses not to do so because its public turns against the conflict. That's not something that happened very often, if ever, prior to the 18th century, but of course it's happened quite a few times since then.
Vietnam.
That was one of the biggest examples in the last couple hundred years of the same pattern repeating itself.
All right. On the same point of public opinion, Max, invisible armies, I'm quoting once again, today insurgency and counterinsurgency have to be waged not only on the ground but in cyberspace and on satellite television. These are realms where innovative Islamist groups such as al-Qaeda and Hezbollah have excelled and more hidebound conventional militaries have lagged, close quote. How would you grade the United States for waging the war of public opinion?
I don't think we've done a very good job, and I think our military and political leaders would be the first to admit it, that it's very hard for us to counter the claims that these propagandists make in cyberspace and other realms. Now, the good news from our perspective is that although we're not very good at waging this battle of ideas, many of the things that our enemies do discredit themselves with public opinion because they are so ferocious and so ready to kill even fellow Muslims that their reputation in the Muslim world has gone down dramatically over the course of the past 10 years. So in many ways, they are their own worst enemies. But we have not been all that skillful, I would say, at countering their propaganda.
Do you draw a distinction between the Bush administration and the Obama administration in the effort to wage the war of public opinion? Barack Obama went to Cairo, gave a speech. Just earlier this autumn, he met with the president of Iran in the United Nations. Both of these obviously calculated, at least in part, to have an effect on Islamist opinion, right? Or opinion in the Middle East generally.
I don't think you can say that President Obama has had a lot of success in selling the United States and the Muslim world. Yes, he got good press for his Cairo speech, but if you actually look at American public approval ratings in countries across the Middle East, in many cases they're lower than they were under the Bush presidency. And with President Obama's outreach to Iran and his handling of Syria, I mean, whatever you may think of those individual instances, the result of that has been a decline in confidence in many countries in the Arab world that are opposed to the Iranian regime, that are opposed to the Assad regime in Syria. They want to see a tougher American line. And so they haven't, you know, the reputation of the U.S. and of President Obama are not high in most of that region.
Conventional tactics don't work against an unconventional threat.
Well, this is the hardest thing for a normal soldier to wrap his or her mind around, because there's a tendency for soldiers to think, okay, we've got an enemy, let's go get them. Let's use as much firepower as we need. Let's root them out, destroy them, annihilate them. Well, yes, that works if the enemy is wearing uniforms and you know exactly where they are. You can go out and annihilate them. The problem when you're fighting a guerrilla foe is they're not wearing a uniform. And if you go out there and you just kill a bunch of people or you round up a bunch of people, you may wind up creating more enemies than you eliminate. That's one of the most basic lessons of counterinsurgency warfare. And yet it's a lesson that we ignored for many years in Vietnam. And it's a lesson we ignored again in the early years of Iraq. And it was only when we started to figure that out in Iraq during the surge in 2007, 2008, that our military fortunes began to reverse.
Population-centric, I'm quoting once again from Invisible Armies, population-centric counterinsurgency is often successful, but it's not as touchy-feely as commonly supposed.
Well, population-centric counterinsurgency is another term for what's more often called hearts and minds. And a lot of people have this idea of hearts and minds that it means you go out and spend a lot of money, you try to win the love and support of the population.
Build schools, build roads,
right,
and so
that,
forth.
All right. That touchy-feely kind of stuff. And in fact, we did that in both Iraq and Afghanistan for years, and we wasted billions of dollars in the process, because the hard lesson of history is, okay, people may like having a new hospital, they may like having a new school, but they're not going to support you if it's going to result in them getting killed. Fundamental matters of security are what matter most. And if you can't establish basic security, if you can't protect the populace from the insurgents, then all the money you're spending on public works projects, it's all going to go down the drain, or may actually support the insurgency. So you got to, hearts and minds, population-centric counterinsurgency is really, it's not about winning the love and affection of the population. It's about controlling the population. It's about putting your troops out among the people 24/7, so like in the same way that the police patrol a major city all the time to keep crime at bay and to reassure the people that they are safe.
What's your reading of the Pentagon as an entity? Has it got this lesson down now? This Iraq went wrong. It was in some ways just in the sense, at least, that it was a two-phase war. Phase one, we get everything wrong. Phase two, things start to come around because we changed our tactics. In that sense, at least, it was a parallel experience to Vietnam. Have they learned?
I'm not so certain that they have. I see a lot of the same process that we saw after Vietnam of trying to consign this experience down a memory hole. Although there's a lot of tremendous experience in the military now. I mean, our military, as a result of Iraq and Afghanistan, has really become the finest counterinsurgency force in the world. But right now, they're not focused on keeping that knowledge and that capability in being. What they're focused on right now is on cutting the budget And a lot of people in Washington are saying, well, we're never going to fight another ground war again, so we can just eviscerate the Army. Let's put all of our money into the Navy and Air Force, which have very little interest, of course, in counterinsurgency. And so I'm afraid that we
counterinsurgency is a ground game. It's always going to be a ground game.
I mean, obviously,
is that right?
You know, obviously air power has a large supporting role, but fundamentally it is going to be a ground game until, you know, insurgents don't have the capability to dogfight with our fighter aircraft. All they have the capability to do is attack our troops or others on the ground, and that's what they're going to do.
Invisible armies again. Establishing legitimacy is vital for any successful insurgency or counterinsurgency, and in modern times that is hard to achieve for a foreign group or government. And you made the point that when we were engaged in counterinsurgency in the Philippines, we were supporting a legitimate, democratically established government. But, well, I'll just quote you, it was more of a challenge to achieve legitimacy. It was more of a challenge in South Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq, where the United States was trying to create legitimate governments from scratch. Can we create legitimate governments from scratch?
I think it is possible, but it's very hard to do. I mean, we sort of did it in the case of South Korea, which has been this amazing success story, going from being devastated in the 1950s to being one of the top 10 economies in the world today. But there are many more failures than that particular success story. We haven't had a lot of luck, obviously, certently in South Vietnam, certainly in, I would say, in Iraq. I don't think we've had that much luck in Afghanistan.
Max, the Korean War ends in 1953. When does South Korea become a democracy?
The 1980s.
So it's three decades.
It's a long process.
All right.
And you got to have patience. That's one of the other big lessons that I draw is you can't expect overnight victories. We all have this idea that the military idea was something like the Six-Day War, where you go out and you annihilate the enemy in 6 days. You can do that against the conventional adversary. You really can't do that against an entrenched insurgency. It can take years, decades even, to defeat that kind of threat.
Invisible armies. Technology has been less important in guerrilla war than in conventional war, but that may be changing. The role of weapons could grow if insurgents get their hands on chemical, biological, or especially nuclear weapons. Give me some likelihood on that.
Well, we're already seeing, you know, insurgents have more destructive power at their fingertips than they had a century ago, or even that many conventional armies had. I mean, just compare the attack at Pearl Harbor carried out by the Imperial Japanese Navy and the attack of 9/11 carried out by fewer than two dozen terrorist fanatics. And the terrorist fanatics killed more people than the entire Imperial Japanese Navy did in 1941. That's unfortunately a microcosm of the trend, which is that guerrillas can cause more and more destruction and damage. We're seeing that with the IEDs and the other kinds of attacks they've carried out in Iraq and Afghanistan. But unfortunately, those are relatively low-tech guerrillas. The real nightmare scenario is that you will have more sophisticated enemies in the future who will, in fact, have nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons, in which case our casualties may be not in the thousands, but in the millions. That's truly an existential threat and one we have to focus on. We don't have the luxury of saying, as we did in the past, as the military often has in the past, that's just an ankle-biter, nuisance type of threat. We're not going to focus our energy on it. We have to focus our energy on it because it's not a threat on a distant battlefield today. It's a threat right here on the home front.
Drones. Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, we've used drones. I've forgotten the count, but it's a high count. It's scores to kill Islamists from the air. Is that a correct policy? Does that get to the question of legitimacy, of public opinion, of violence without putting people on the ground? Is that what do you make of that?
I would argue that drones are necessary but not sufficient to achieve something approximating victory. I mean, we tend to get too focused on drones, and they've become kind of the flavor of the month in Washington. Mm-hmm. But in fact, drones are just another way of doing leadership targeting, which has been going on since the dawn of time. It's just another way to try to kill or arrest the leaders of an insurgency. And what history generally teaches you is that you can do that, and you can try to keep the insurgency off balance by doing that. But if it's a large, well-entrenched insurgency, you're not going to defeat it by killing a few people at the top. They're just going to be replaced by somebody, often somebody even more noxious. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at Israel, which is in the past has killed the leaders of Hamas and Hezbollah, and Hamas and Hezbollah are still around as strong as ever. You really have to be able to have some kind of ground presence. It doesn't have to be our presence, and it's not going to be our presence in most cases, but whether it's going to be the Pakistani army or the Yemeni army or the Libyan army, somebody's actually got to physically police the physical space where these terrorists operate and to prevent them from entrenching themselves. And if you don't do that, drones are just the Band-Aid solution. They're not a cure for the problem.
Syria. President Obama kept us out of a conflict as it killed about 100,000 people in Syria. Then the regime uses chemical weapons, kills something like 1,500 more people. The president threatens military action, calls on Congress to hold a vote, and then the Soviets move in with a diplomatic initiative under which the Syrians are voluntarily to permit outsiders to destroy their chemical weapons, and the military threat is called off. That's the narrative arc. What do you make of it?
Well, I think the obvious point, one which the entire world has now digested, is it makes us look weak. It makes us look like when the President of the United States says there's a red line, he doesn't really mean it, which is going to be trouble down the road when we're offering red lines to other rogue states.
But the President says, the editorial page of the New York Times says, Thomas Friedman writing in the New York Times says, weakness, faw. The President threatened force and got a very desirable diplomatic outcome.
Well,
what's weak about that? We got what we wanted.
Well, it wasn't a credible threat of force because everybody saw that Congress was not going to vote for that resolution. So I don't think there was a real threat there. But the larger issue to my mind in Syria is I think we're paralyzed by this notion that there are bad guys on both sides, that Assad and his people are bad. But then on the other side, the myth is that they're all al-Qaeda-type terrorists. And so a lot of people seem to think the best thing we can do is just to let them fight it out.
Senator Rand Paul, I think this is a quotation. It's a close paraphrase, if not. There are no good guys in Syria.
Right. And so the upshot of that is a lot of people say just let them fight it out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the problem is even if you accept that analysis, which is not really true because the best intelligence estimates are that the al-Qaeda-type fighters are only about 20% of the rebel ranks. But even if you say that they're the dominant force, and they are a very strong force, what is the result of our staying on the sidelines? Essentially, what you're seeing is Hezbollah and the Iranians on one side and the al-Qaeda types on the other are carving up the country between them. The al-Qaeda folks are in control of a lot of northern Syria. Hezbollah and the Quds force and the Assad loyalists are in control of Damascus and other parts. That's, from our standpoint, that's the worst possible outcome.
Why? What's the American interest here?
Well, you have extremists on both sides, very anti-American. Hezbollah, which has been targeting American interests since the dark days of Beirut 1983 when they blew up our Marine barracks. On the other side, you have these al-Qaeda fanatics who are fighting American troops in Iraq and in many cases have moved across the border. This has become a magnet for jihadists from around the world. What we've seen in previous conflicts like this in places like Iraq or especially in Afghanistan is that once they come to a place like this and get trained, they often migrate outward and wind up attacking targets in Europe or even in the United States. So for us, I think this is a very dangerous scenario that we are allowing to unfold.
Max, let's turn for a moment to Israel. Israel faces a classic insurgency in Hezbollah in Lebanon, based in Lebanon. They're receiving outside support, again, a classic pattern from both Syria and Iran. And Syria possesses chemical weapons, and Iran is working hard to achieve nuclear weapons, again, something that you warn against in Invisible Armies. You are now a member of the Israeli Security Cabinet. What do you do?
What do you do about the Iranian nukes, or what do you do about the larger issue of the insurgencies that Israel faces?
Well, what I had in mind was, what do you do about the insurgencies? But the next question was going to be, what do you do about the Iranian nukes?
Well, I don't have a solution on the Iranian nukes because a lot of that really has to be based on a very classified intelligence assessment that the Israelis have to conduct in terms of how much damage can they actually do to the Iranian nuclear facilities if all they can do is to shut them down for 6 months and in return they're going to face terrorist retaliation from Hezbollah, it may not be worthwhile. But if they can do greater damage, it may make sense. And I don't have those those facts and figures. But I will say that the larger issue that Israel faces goes back to exactly what I was saying. The only way you can truly defeat an entrenched insurgency is by offering better governance, by offering law and order to the people so that the insurgents, the terrorists or guerrillas, cannot operate. But Israel is unwilling or unable to do that because it has no desire to administer Arab lands.
So Sharon's withdrawal from Gaza was a mistake?
No, I'm not saying that, because the Israelis don't want to be administering Gaza, just like they don't want to be administering Lebanon. They don't want to be imperialists. They don't want to rule over Palestinians or Lebanese or anybody else. But they have to understand the cost of their not being imperialists, the cost of their not administering these areas is they have no way to eradicate Hamas and Hezbollah. All they can do is attack them every once in a while and try to deter them from attacking Israel. But fundamentally, the only way you can uproot them is with better government. And unfortunately, the Lebanese government isn't doing it. The Palestinian Authority isn't doing it. And Israel isn't doing it. And so that's why you have Hamas and Hezbollah in a position of relative strength.
Last question. I'm going to quote Invisible Armies one more time. If armed with nuclear weapons, a small terrorist cell the size of a platoon might have more killing capacity than the entire army of a non-nuclear state like Brazil or Egypt. That is a sobering thought. It suggests that in the future, low-intensity conflict could pose even greater problems for the world's leading powers than it has in the past. How well prepared is the United States?
Well, I'm not sure that we are well prepared for a attack with weapons of mass destruction. I mean, we've done certain things to try to defend ourselves, and we have civilian response plans in effect, but it's just such a cataclysmic event. It's hard to even wrap your mind around what it would mean, what the implications would be. It's so horrific that we don't even want to think about it. As a result of that, if heaven forbid it were ever to happen, I don't think we'd be well prepared. But the larger issue that I want to call attention to is just how incredibly important it is to understand this mode of warfare, because it's not an aberration. It's not something that ended with the Vietnam War or the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. It's something that's always been with us, always will be, and is actually the final point that I want to make and that you're bringing out is it's actually getting more important than ever. It's becoming a matter of life and death right here at home to understand the history and the operations of insurgent forces.
Max Boot, author of Invisible Armies, An Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson.